Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and around the world in business and in politics. Here's what's coming up on today's show.
If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus rather than a war. Not missiles, but microbes. But we've actually invested very little in a system to stop an epidemic. We're not ready for the next epidemic.
Yep, that was Bill Gates talking about a possible pandemic way back in 2015. And unless you've been living under a rock, you've likely heard one of those talks. It's a TED talk. But who's behind the brand that has inspired millions? Later, I'll be talking to Bruno Giussani, who was the global curator of TED since 2005. He's orchestrated talks from the likes of Pope Francis through to Bill Gates and thousands of others. And we'll find out why he's coming to Dublin. Then we're going to be diving into a very hot topic in energy. Jamie Smith, the energy correspondent for the Financial Times, will be here to explain how the US is gearing up to test the waters for a nuclear fuel revival and an issue that could have implications for energy markets worldwide. And finally, in our techscape slot, the Irish election campaign has never been more digital. But what's behind all the buzz? Elaine Burke, host for Tech's Sake podcast, has been analysing all of the party's manifestos to uncover how they're tackling AI. And she's going to break down who's embracing innovation and who's falling behind. That's all coming up here on Taking Stock. You can email us at takingstock@newstalk.com or we're on X at StockNT. Now, today, we're going to start with this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
Now, first up today, we're going to turn to the general election. The cost of living and healthcare remain two of the main big ticket policy issues that are exercising voters in the run-up. But there are two areas that are notably absent from the debating podiums, with the potential for an isolationist Trump presidency underscoring the need for domestic investment in Irish tech firms and AI. Is the roadmap to do that missing from party manifestos? Well, I'm joined now by Elaine Burke, who's host of For Tech's Sake podcast and the Connected AI podcast. Elaine, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Yeah, great to be here.
Now, Elaine, as I said there, it's kind of missing from the debate as far as I see it. Mm. But have you been looking at what each individual party has been doing? Is there anyone mentioning it particularly? Is there anyone doing well?
Well, I kind of went to the source. I went to the manifestos and I went through them to try and find out if they were kind of talking about AI in that sense. Because you're right, I don't think it's really coming up as much in the media debates. And that might be because they do seem to have a bit of consensus about where they're at with AI. Each of the manifestos is kind of raising the prospect of AI having a lot of potential for opportunities, but also raising a lot of concerns for risk. And that's seems to be felt across the board. And also we, you know, being part of the EU, we are in a state that is governed by the incoming AI Act, which is now available for people to become familiar with, but its implementation is going to be slowly rolled out in the coming years, essentially. Now, what happens in practice with the AI Act, we still have to wait and see. But as a nation, the voices that are coming through from these manifestos, they seem to be very much aligned with what is already outlined in that AI Act, and they don't seem to divert too much away from that. Like, even when they say things like some parties have mentioned specifically the use of facial recognition technology, which is a form of AI, by police force such as An Garda Síochána, and they may have mentioned that they want to restrict that to only certain types of crimes, like high level crimes, or they might say that they are happy to allow the Gardaí to use that as long as it's used in certain forms of oversight and with certain restrictions. That's already provided for in the AI Act. Mm. So there are some things that are said that this is what our party will do. And it's kind of like, well, that's what you're going to have to do anyway, because that's what the law says. Yeah.
So do you feel there's a bit of putting it in as a reference point, but there's not a lot of innovative advancement?
If I could be totally frank, I think of all the manifestos that I read, I think the most lip service-y one was probably Fine Gael's. Now, that's just a reading of their AI mentions. They just seemed to be a little bit more offhand. Like, they did mention it in education and using it to advance teaching and learning methods, but it's just kind of like a throwaway comment, and there's usually nothing specific on that. The other manifestos did tend to have something more specific here and there about things. Fianna Fáil actually has quite a lot on AI and digital transformation in its manifesto, but from what I read of it, it was policies that are already in place and plans that are already taking shape. They refer to things like a target of 90% digital intensity for small businesses in Ireland. That's a target that's already in place. There's some that also, many of them actually agree that there needs to be a review of, say, national AI strategy, which we do. We have a national AI strategy. It was launched in 2021.
Oh, we do have one. I didn't even know
that.
Yeah,
and it's an AI for good strategy. So it kind of has that.
As opposed to an AI for bad strategy?
Ideally, yeah. We would like it to be good. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's from 2021. And that's probably why people are less familiar with it. Because me being someone who's like covered AI for a long time, that would have interested me. But AI only really entered the public interest, say, in 2023 in a big way with the rise of generative AI. So that strategy predates even our knowledge of generative AI and its capabilities and its potentials. But they have already issued a refresh, not a full review of the document, but a refresh was released earlier this month from the current government. And that does try to take into account what we now know about AI in terms of generative AI and what we now know in terms of disinformation risk and that kind of stuff. Because previous to that, AI was more about things like automation, pattern recognition, things like facial recognition technology and those kind of use cases. So it has required that review. So some of them are calling for a further review, but like we do have a current refresh in place. So I don't know how substantive that would be as an action to take. And then there's also like there are things about like infrastructure that would be needed as well. If we were to try to have a robust AI strategy, what does that mean in terms of like data centres being built here and the infrastructure required for that? And that is raised in some of the manifestos as well. Some of them raise it from a capacity of advocating for a climate conscious AI development strategy, and the Social Democrats in particular have advocated for that. I think Labour actually is advocating strictly in the areas of workplace surveillance. They're the only one to mention this kind of area for workers, and they're not keen on the idea of algorithmic management of workforces either. And algorithms are also kind of part of the AI world and the AI science. So they are obviously talking to workers, the kind of union groups that would be involved in their party, to kind of frame where they're coming from with their AI policy. So they're one of the ones who came up with that stuff. And then a couple of them, I think the Social Democrats and Sinn Féin, both mentioned things about artists and creators and the concerns that they're raising in terms of AI, both as workers in terms of their rights and as artists and creators in terms of like copyright and intellectual property rights. But really, they're just kind of raising these as issues that are out there probably among their party members, among the people that they're speaking to. But they wouldn't be too specific on what they can do with things. There's lots of promise in that.
And do we have any kind of digital structure now? Does there something... We have a junior minister in enterprise.
In the Ministry of Department of Enterprise, kind of has taken the lead on digital. Digital is part of his brief. There's more elements to his brief, but digital is part of his brief. But if you were to look at really digitally advanced countries, you're talking the likes of the Baltic nations are really good at this. Estonia would be a leader in this space, like probably seen as one of the leaders in terms of digital democracy. And actually, Eastern Europe is quite strong on this, generally speaking. And what you find in those very digital forward nations is that they do have a ministry department that's dedicated to this as an area, and they do have really advanced public services that are digitized in many, many ways. So a lot of the manifestos talk about digitizing public services, leveraging AI to do that, but doing so in a responsible way. And they all kind of use that language around doing it responsibly, ethically, with a human in the loop for decision making and things like that. So they are definitely conscious of the things that are being talked about in the areas of AI and risk and what are the right words to say in terms of that. But I think this idea of a Department of Digital is quite interesting because it really gives a focus point to this kind of stuff. It really takes it seriously. And if you're talking about digitizing public services, the countries that have done that well tend to have leadership in government that is specifically focused on that area.
That's really interesting. You know, when you're talking there, I thought going into this discussion, it was going to be a bit like climate was maybe 20 years ago, where you see parties in the manifesto, I've got a big section on climate and that's it done. But with AI, it's so ubiquitous, isn't it, in our lives that it has to be everywhere. And I know like a lot of it is probably building and stuff that's happening anyway, but it is sort of omnipresent. They can't avoid it now. They've got to build it in. And out of those people that you looked at, do you want to take a stab at who you felt was best? Because I know you said it was Fine Gael who probably did the most sort of lip service, but if you don't want to do it, it's fine.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. I'm just going off of what's in their manifestos and maybe individual members of parties and things like that. Like I would say Derek O'Leary, I have spoken to him on aspects of AI and he does seem to be informed in that area as an individual minister. As far as manifestos go, I suppose the Labour manifesto I felt was very well thought out and it does kind of speak to their values as a party in terms of AI, and I think that's why it was so well thought out.
Yeah.
So just judging off the manifestos, I think theirs was quite robust in that way.
And it does, as you say, a lot of it dealing with the workforce side of things. It leans into their own policy agenda from the party's point of view, but it also is a big area of concern for a lot of people when they talk about AI. It's always, oh, what's going to happen to jobs? Is it going to replace people? Do you feel that the party's adequately dealt with that?
They all raise that as a potential concern. But there's nothing really said more than that is a worry. That is something we should think about. So it's a lot about forming committees, reviewing strategies, being conscious of these things, having maybe advisory boards. That the Social Democrats recommends an advisory board that comes from like a civil society fundamental rights background. But it's worth mentioning that the government currently has an AI advisory council, and there's a lot of leading academics in AI on that, and it's led by Dr. Patricia Scanlon as Ireland's AI ambassador, and she describes herself not just as an ambassador of AI but an ambassador of ethical AI, and I think that's something that's really substantial about her and her work. I mean, she comes from a background of entrepreneurship herself, and she founded a company around the idea that voice recognition technology was actually excluding children. It wasn't really programmed to understand children's voices very well, and that meant when it came to maybe in terms of education, leveraging what you can do with AI to support people, they were getting missed out. And that has led to the development of Soapbox Labs, which is a company that specialised in voice recognition technology for children, and then was able to create this early intervention system using AI and voice recognition for children who may be having difficulties learning, reading and with comprehension and stuff like that at a very early age. And the earlier you can get in interventions like that, the better. So to have someone like that in that position, and that's going to continue this council. So whatever government takes shape, this council is still there. So we do actually have some high level advisory positions there in place.
Elaine, one of the other things you mentioned is the bigger bit of all of this is the infrastructure. Can we attract new tech companies here? Can we build the infrastructure for them to come to Ireland and continue to have a massive presence? Do you have any assessment of what the party's done on that front?
Yeah, I think there's something that they'll have a challenge with there in terms of social acceptance of the aspect of building more data centres in Ireland, because there's been a lot of reporting around the issues that brings to our energy grid. They're not actually allowed to add to that at the moment.
And they won't say there's a moratorium, but effectively it's not. There's no new ones.
Yeah, that's the situation we're in now. And that's an issue of tension at the moment in the industry, in terms of policy. And I mean, even in my own work, like I'd be someone who likes to talk about we shouldn't have tech for tech's sake. I mean, it's why my podcast is called what it's called. So I'm not keen on the idea of massive data centres that are existing to have a huge imprint on, like they may not have a carbon imprint because they try to
offset it
yep. and they use renewable energy, but they actually end up becoming like huge consumers of the renewable energy available. And that's also a problem. So they have this impact. And if that's just so that we can have thousands and thousands of social media posts that no one's ever going to look at again in a data center, I'm not really keen on that idea. I think that's a wasteful use of resources. But if you were to use those data centers to house things like thousands and thousands and thousands of medical records that can also be analyzed for pattern recognition to help in early diagnoses, that would be a really good use of that technology. So it would be good to see that kind of come to the fore. We're talking about this conversation about the infrastructure around AI. Like, convey to people the good that can be done here and maybe make it so that it is AI for good, as the National AI Strategy was called, mm-hmm. and not just AI for AI's sake.
Well, that's a good way to round it out for us. And we will be talking about those data centres and the energy issues around them later on in the programme. But Elaine, thank you so much for putting all that work into examining what's going on in the tech and AI space. We really appreciate it. That was Elaine Burke, host of For Tech's Sake podcast and the Connected AI podcast. Elaine, thank you very much for coming into us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up, Jamie Smith is the Financial Times energy correspondent, and he'll be here to explain how the US are about to test the appetite for nuclear fuel. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, take a quick listen to this.
Line up the valves and put the turbine on a turning gear.
Somebody turn off the goddamned alarm.
Thank you. Jesus. Supposed to be able to give orders to a racket like that. Are you within limits, Ted?
Yeah, it's going to level out okay.
System status. Reactor pressure back to normal.
Right. Set the research flow to minimum, guys.
Jack.
Good.
Phone for you.
Jack, we still have high radiation on level 8.
Perfectly normal.
Feed water flow 450,000 pounds per hour, and it's decreasing.
Get out of here.
Jack, Bill Gibson, the district's gallery.
Yep.
We got some people here from Channel 3. They're shooting a TV news special at the plant. Listen, what the hell's going on down here?
It's just a routine turbine trip, Bill. Okay? So just take it easy. There's nothing to worry about.
I want to level in a reactor.
We're still on main artillery, Howard.
That was, of course, the unmistakable Jack Lemmon playing the head of a nuclear power station in the film The China Syndrome. Now, that film was based on an explosion in the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania. The accident, which was the worst in US nuclear history, caused the plant to shut down in 1979. However, there are plans now to reopen a nuclear facility at that site in 2028. Not everybody is happy about this. There's growing opposition to the plan, which is backed by Microsoft. I'm delighted now that Jamie Smith, the energy editor of the Financial Times, who's been following this story, joins me on the line now. Jamie, you're welcome back to Taking Stock.
Hello, Mandy.
Now, just for those listeners who won't know and what happened, or remind us what actually happened in 1979.
So, yeah, in 1979, basically the US had its worst nuclear accident in its history. It was at a nuclear power plant called Three Mile Island. There were two nuclear reactors at the plant, which is based in Pennsylvania. And one of those reactors suffered a partial meltdown. So basically, through a combination of a technical problem and human error, the operators at the plant failed to properly shut down a system, and some radiation leaked out of the plant. So nobody died as a result of this, but it caused panic and chaos, and it was the really terrible response by the local authorities and the regulatory authorities, which really, you know, dented nuclear power's, I think it dented public, support for nuclear power in a big way.
Yeah.
So I think there was 140,000 people self-evacuated around the plant whenever the local authorities basically failed to give proper orders on what to do. So yeah, it's sort of something that resonates with American people when they think of nuclear power.
And you've been writing about this lately. Why?
So actually, I visited the Three Mile Island plant and got a tour there a couple of weeks ago, because what we're seeing in the US is a revival and interest in nuclear power. So there are plans to restart several nuclear reactors which have previously been shut down. And there's also plans to set up new, what's called small modular reactors, which are smaller and people say more efficient type of nuclear power reactor.
Mm.
And that's because the U.S. is experiencing, you know, a massive surge in power demand. So we've got the artificial intelligence revolution, and companies like Microsoft and Google and Amazon are building lots of these AI data centers, and they suck up and use a lot of electricity to make the AI work. So there's basically a huge need for new sources of power in the US, and nuclear is seen as a clean form of energy. So it doesn't create the carbon emissions that you get from oil or gas or coal, and that is very attractive to these big tech giants, because they've got very strict climate targets. So they're really keen to get their hands on any type of power that doesn't create carbon emissions.
Mm. And we'll come back to exactly what's going to happen there in a moment, but we might just look for a little second at the wider question of why nuclear is kind of maybe getting a bit of a revival in the US, and this is a kind of test case for whether or not local communities will allow that to happen. But you mentioned there's the data centers issue, which is AI driven largely, and we're having that very same discussion here. There's other issues though, Jamie, like manufacturing, reshoring manufacturing and transport electrification that are all driving more demand for power. Is that debate a big one in the US about where you get the power from? Or, like, I'm just trying to get a sense of how real is this nuclear solution over there?
Yeah, I mean, so you're definitely right. The AI data center power demand issue is one part of it, but you also have the reshoring of manufacturing. That's been a key theme of the Biden administration. You know, they passed all these tax breaks, grants and incentives to lure manufacturers to set up here in the US, and they've been relatively successful in that. And that takes, you know, that takes a lot of power to get manufacturing going. And then you've also got the electrification. So EVs are rolling out in the US, probably not as fast as in Europe and certainly not as fast as in China, but the electrification trend is happening. So people reckon here that the power demand that we're seeing, power demand was flatlining in the US over the last 20 years. It wasn't going up because you had energy efficiency, you know, and appliances, and everyone was focused on energy efficiency. But now it could double over the next decade, which would be a huge change. And so that's why utilities and everyone in the industry is looking to see where they can source new power. They're very worried that the price of power is going to go up, you know, a lot and hit consumers. So everyone's scrambling around. They're looking at gas as one potential solution. But the problem with that is that it creates carbon emissions. So the big tech giants in particular are worried about that. Then you have nuclear, and you have renewables. The one really good thing about nuclear is it doesn't create any carbon emissions, but it's also a very stable and reliable type of power. It provides 24/7 power. You know, you just turn the switch and it continues to generate, whereas renewables such as wind and solar, they are intermittent and you need batteries to back them up. And, you know, there can be a reliability issue. Mm. For those data centers, they really need stable, reliable power. They can't have outages.
Yeah, and it's that dispatchable energy that can be stored and, you know, flicked on. But it's not without its challenges, I guess, and we'll come into what they all are in a moment. But maybe I just want to look a little bit at the Microsoft deal that we're talking about in relation to the Three Mile Island project. What's the money like around something like that? And are they trying to kind of contain their own energy source now? Is that what these platforms are at?
Certainly, yes. I mean, they're all desperate to secure energy because they won't be able to build the data centers to power their AI revolution if they don't get the energy to do so. And that's a strategic issue for the companies, but also for the US. If it wants to lead in the AI revolution, you know, and be ahead of China, it really needs to get these data centers rolled out. So that is a huge issue. And that's why the tech giants like Microsoft, Google and Amazon are really turning to nuclear power because they see it stable and low emissions. I mean, how much are the tech giants willing to pay for nuclear power? It looks like they're willing to pay much more than other users to secure this clean, dispatchable power. So we don't have details of the Microsoft contract. They've kept it secret. What we do know is it's a 20-year power purchase agreement, and analysts reckon they're willing to pay between 110 and 115 megawatts per hour for the clean energy. And that is about double what other users are willing to pay. So that is what is covering the cost of restarting these large nuclear reactors and potentially also rolling out these smaller reactors. But basically, the big tech guys are going to pay much more than anyone else to do it. And then secondarily, the Biden administration has been very generous in the amount of money it's been willing to pump into the nuclear sector to get these reactors restarted and new ones rolling out. You know, they're offering a grant to a separate nuclear facility, which is restarting, of $1.6 billion. It's one which is being set up by Holtec in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And it looks like Three Mile Island will also probably apply for a similar type of grant.
Isn't it funny, Jamie, that more and more all over the world, if people are trying to attract these large data centres and these big tech companies, what they're saying is you've got to be self-sufficient in terms of energy and don't depend on the state to do it. Do you think that Trump is likely to, you know, support the Biden direction on something like this? Or what is he saying?
So, yeah, the Trump administration is really going to turn U.S. energy policy on its head. It's going to, in particular, really push the boundaries for the oil and gas companies. You know, his phrase is drill, baby, drill. Mm. You're going to get a big push for the oil and gas industry. Renewables are going to be hit probably reasonably hard. I think wind in particular, which Trump has said he'd like to shut down all offshore wind on day one of his administration. So it's a problem for the offshore wind industry. It won't completely collapse, you know, because there's some projects up and running, particularly onshore wind and solar. But the pace of that renewable rollout will be slowed. For nuclear, it's quite interesting. The Trump administration and the Republicans have generally been favorable towards nuclear, and it's an area of a rare area of bipartisanship here in the US. So that's positive for the nuclear sector. But I think one issue might be, will the Trump administration provide just as much of the grants and loans and tax breaks that the Biden administration has been willing to do? I think that's an open question. To be honest, it might not provide exactly the same level of support.
Yeah, it's interesting, like looking even back to the 70s and later, like what another thing, not just the confidence, but undermined the nuclear energy progress was probably a lot to do with cheap gas, cheap American shale gas that kind of did for it in the end as well. Jamie, I just want to get a sense of what it was like, you know, visiting that site. Like it closed in 1979. Does it look like a 1979 building inside? Like, I mean, is it kind of stuck in time? And how much do you think, or is there any estimation of what it would take to, you know, make it fit for purpose or digitize it for the modern age?
Yes, it was fascinating being, you know, driven around the whole facility and then allowed to enter the control room at one of the Three Mile Island reactors and to see the cooling towers. You know, there's four huge cooling towers which stretch into the sky. There's grass growing underneath them, you know, and they're going to need refurbished to start up. And the control room really is a step back in time. You know, it looks like the sort of control room you'd see in the 1970s. You know, it's levers, dials, there's no digital screens. So it really is a throwback. And actually, what they're going to do is that they are going to refurbish this and they're going to check everything. But actually, you know, it's a restart which will, they're not going to digitize everything. You know, they're going to keep the existing sort of fixtures of what they can. They're just going to upgrade them a bit. So it will be, you know, quite an old, historic looking plant when it restarts. I mean, one of the interesting things about Three Mile Island is that there's two reactors on site. So there's what they call the first reactor, TMI-1, which ran successfully for, you know, many, many years. And, you know, it didn't shut down after the accident in the second reactor. You know, it was shut down for a period, but then it was reopened again. And it only finally closed in 2019. And the reason that reactor was closed was because the shale gas revolution in the US created just such an abundance of cheap gas that nuclear couldn't compete on price. So it priced Three Mile Island out of the market. It was shut down in 2019. But now with the re-entry or the entry of these big tech giants willing to pay far more for electricity, then it's given this opportunity for the first reactor at Three Mile Island to be restarted.
So there's obviously a lot of hurdles before it does start. In 2028, I think, is what you said the aim for the reopening is. So it's got those legal threats from the protesting people. It has obviously a lot of regulatory stuff to go through. Staff, I'm guessing, will be an issue as well to train people. But what about the hearts and minds of local people? What's the feeling like there now at the moment about it?
So I spent a little bit of time in Middletown, which is the small town beside the plant. I spoke to trade union representatives who are all in favour of the plant going ahead. In fact, the person I spoke to, Joe Gussler, his father worked at the plant. He himself worked on the plant. So he was very much in favour of this, and they see it as bringing local jobs and money into the local community. You know, the company Constellation's talking about creating 600 new jobs there and contributing, you know, billions of dollars in tax revenue. So from the trade union's perspective, they're very keen. I went into a local cafe. You know, the manager there was very, very positive about more money coming into the community. So there are a lot of people in favor, but then there are a hardcore group of veteran activists who, you know, they're in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, who fought for many years to get the plant closed. And they are furious that this has happened, that this is reopening. And they are saying that they're going to hold protests and they're going to, you know, make a legal campaign to try and delay the opening or block it altogether. So certainly it's a bit of a divided community. And Constellation did do a survey and they say the vast majority of people are in favour. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. Nuclear is a very sensitive issue. My thoughts would be it probably will get to go ahead and it will get going. But I would be very nervous about the 2028 start date because there's a lot of hurdles to overcome. I mean, you mentioned staffing, 600 staff. It's difficult to get 600 skilled nuclear staff up and running. It takes 18 months to train people. So that is certainly a challenge. And nuclear supply chains generally and getting some of the equipment they need to get restarted, you know, they are very stretched at the minute because there is such a boom in the industry. So it's certainly going to be, you know, a real challenge for Constellation to get it going on time.
It certainly is. Jamie, it's a fascinating read. Thank you very much for taking the time to take us through all that today. If people want to read it, it's still on the Financial Times website. That was Jamie Smith, US Energy Editor of the Financial Times. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mandy.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Mandy Johnston. And after the break, we'll talk to the man behind the TED Talk phenomenon, how it all started and where it's going next. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, one of the biggest broadcasting phenomena of the past 20 years has been the rise of the TED sphere, whether it's the TED Talks in auditoriums or the TED Radio Hour. We've all seen it, or we've all been touched by its simple yet effective format. Well, my next guest was central to the success of that sphere, and he spent 20 years as head of TED's global curator. It's my delight now to welcome to the programme Bruno Giussani. Bruno, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, first of all, it's such an interesting role and it was such a phenomenon and it became so ubiquitous across the globe. We'll get into all of that in a second, but maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and how someone ends up as the global curator of something as big as TED.
Well, somehow when I started, there was no role as global curator and TED was much smaller, right? I started 20 years ago. We were a small group of seven or eight people, and TED was an organization putting up one conference a year in the spring in Monterey, California. About 1,000 people attended the conference every year, but there was no real presence online. There was a small website explaining what TED was. But what we know today about TED, particularly the videos online and all the local conferences under the brand TEDx and plenty of other things, didn't exist at all. So essentially, we created both the model that has become the TED platform with all these different pieces interacting and all going in the same direction, which is the notion of spreading interesting ideas and important knowledge. And we also created our roles. I joined after a couple of decades as a journalist in Switzerland, in Europe, and across the world. And essentially, what we call today a curator of ideas is a role that my colleague Chris Anderson, myself, and a couple of other colleagues invented and developed over time.
And the organization itself now, where is it based and how many people does it employ? I mean, starting off from those very sort of humble beginnings with 8 or 9 staff, what does it look like now?
Yeah, right now it has about 200 employees, most of them in North America. The base is in New York, and it's a nonprofit foundation.
And the concept behind it, I actually went and listened to a TED talk that you did, which was very interesting about teachers in particular, and us all sort of remembering that one teacher we can recall from our days in school and kind of amplifying that to the world. Maybe just talk us through the original concept behind what you were trying to do at that time when you were growing the TED sphere.
So when I started, we were this small group, but we inherited a model that already existed. TED has existed since 1984, as that singular conference I mentioned. And then in the early 2000s, the founder, Richard Wurman, decided to retire and sold it to Chris Anderson, who's from Britain, who was a publisher in Britain, had sold his publishing house and bought TED, turned it into this nonprofit. It was a for-profit before that, and then started building it up, hiring me and a few other people, and then over time, many others. At the beginning, so we inherited two things. We inherited the California conference, and we inherited this model of telling a story in less than 18 minutes. Now, there is a bit of a legend about the 18 minutes kind of time limit for TED Talks, which is that many people for a long time assumed that a TED Talk had to be 18 minutes. But that's never been the case. The case has always been that 18 minutes is like a ceiling, but you don't need necessarily to get there.
You don't have to hit it, yeah.
No, what we tried always to do is to figure out what is the right timing for a specific story, because some stories may feel dragged out and some stories may feel too compressed. And so, you know, you play with the storytelling and you play with the timing and you play with the rhythm of the storytelling in order to create an interesting and compelling experience for whoever is either seeing in a live theater or then watching online or just hearing the audio version. Mm. From there, we have built essentially a multi-entry platform for spreading ideas. One part of it was conferences, both the official TED conferences taking place in North America. And then the reason I joined was to start the first conference in Europe, which was called TED Global and took place for the first time in 2005 in Oxford. And then it moved to Edinburgh and then it moved to Rio de Janeiro and traveled the world. Essentially there were the official TED conferences, which were between 2 and 5 every year. And then this network that maybe some of the people listening have heard about called TEDx, which is a network of local events organized not by the TED team, but by local teams and groups of volunteers who get a license from TED. The license is free, but it commits them to do things in a certain way so that their local event is very similar to what TED would do if TED was coming to that town. And that has allowed for a really wide range of events in hundreds of cities around the world. There's been pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, we hit, I think, 3,800 events a year. And now it's slowly back to roughly that number. Mm. But the events, of course, are only one thing, right? The importance of meeting physically in a theater, experiencing a storyteller telling a story all together. But then, of course, there are the videos and the podcasts and the fellowship and plenty and social media content of any kind, many different parts of this platform for disseminating knowledge.
Yeah, and I think that's something people don't really understand. They think it is just a kind of a singular platform for videos, but I've attended one of those TEDx programs. The franchise of TED is so strong and so powerful. Obviously, there's an element of quality control in what you do. You have to have standards and that has maintained. But why do you think, and what is, I suppose if you could answer this question, we'd all be multimillionaires, but what do you think made it so successful at that particular time?
But, you know, there is always a mix of what you do and the context in which you operate. And often the first thing are choices you make and the second is a bit of luck as well, right? So the choices you made from the very beginning were about not compromising on the quality of what we would put on stage and then release. We're about trying to find compelling, relevant, fresh, new ideas to spread. What about, as you just mentioned, making sure that the content of the talks is sound, is either based on science or facts, or we have a content quality control in the form of fact checking, for example, before the talks get recorded. But then we also had a bit of luck. And the main part of it is timing. So I said before that the original conference was not re-disseminated online. But when we started publishing the first talks in 2006, just as a test, YouTube had just started. And YouTube was a very interesting phenomenon because until then, some people may remember, in order to watch a video online, you had to click on a link and download the full video into your computer and then click play, and it would play on a small window in your on your screen. And then YouTube came along, and others as well, with this notion of video streaming. So you click and the video starts playing. And suddenly video online becomes a thing, combined with the spread of broadband connectivity. And when YouTube started, a lot of YouTube content was cat videos or music videos stolen from MTV and other TV channels. And there we come with, you know, some very interesting, high-level, well-curated videos. And so we hit a moment where there was a sort of lack of good content. And so we were lucky in that sense. And then once the others started catching up, we had already a base of a viewership that was pretty consistent.
And you were well established. So you have the format, you've got the quality control, you now have simultaneously sort of started to grow with the evolution of YouTube, which has grown exponentially. You've had incredibly famous people from the likes of Bill Gates to Pope Francis, which I'll come to you in a moment to talk to you about how you go about getting people like that. But it's not always about famous people, is it? It's about, or how do you pick someone? What do you start looking for when you're trying to find those people who will capture our attention? Because that's the biggest challenge, isn't it, in today's world, actually getting people who will capture people's attention.
Yeah, you know, Mandy, that's actually one of the most interesting things in this whole experience. So it's true that the way you go after finding people is really not dissimilar from what a magazine editor would do with his team, which is, you know, where is the good idea? Who embodies that idea? Is that person the right person to talk about that specific topic? Or is somebody else more qualified? How much space do we give this person? Is this a cover story or is it a one-page story? And so on. So there are all those kind of criteria that are very much classic editorial criteria that play into the choice. And the constant scanning of the environment for new things and new people and new tech and so on. But then the most interesting thing is that some of the most compelling and novel ideas don't come from famous people. Famous people have an impact because they have name recognition, so they attract attention. They have credibility, so that attention gets turned into a certain level of potential impact and so on. But the most novel ideas often come from people that you have never heard of, that are maybe famous within their country or within their field of specialization, but not outside of that. And then they come to that stage and stand up in front of people and start telling a story that nobody has ever heard about, or that reframes, these are the most interesting stories, that reframes the way we see things. I give you an example. It is a very famous TED example, that of Hans Rosling, a social scientist from Sweden. He passed away a few years ago, but back in the time, he has given 6 or 7 TED Talks. He had this very unique and flamboyant way of presenting statistics, which many people find absolutely boring, right? But he could turn them into real stories of how we should look at the world and not be captured by, you know, impressions or opinions or fake news, but really focus on facts. And it really was one of these speakers that surprised everybody when he appeared and then became a global star because of that.
Yeah, and it's such a challenge in today's world to actually cut through with facts. It's a feat in itself, I suppose, to actually, you know, hold people's attention. Maybe just to go back to that, some of the famous people I mentioned in our introduction, we played a clip of Bill Gates talking in 2015 about the pandemic being the biggest challenge that the world was going to face, and wasn't he ahead of his time? But what about someone like Pope Francis? How does someone like you sit down and say, okay, I think we should go and try and get the Pope, and how do you do that?
Well, Pope Francis is, of course, an interesting character for many reasons, not last the fact that what he says reaches beyond the confines of his community, of the Catholic Church, right? Mm-hmm. Many people don't like him, but many, many people consider him a moral compass in today's confused world. He has written several interesting books, encyclical letters, but not technically books, since he's been Pope. And at a certain point, he kind of started playing with the idea of can we find a way to bring him to this platform? Of course, there are many difficulties in doing this. The first one was the first time I traveled to the Vatican trying to talk about TED with some contacts there. No one knew what TED was, literally. So you need to start with a lot of explaining, right? A lot of explaining about who you are, about why is this thing worth a minute of the Pope's time, which is very precious, is, you know, in huge demand from all over the world, and so on. What could this add to his message, and so on? So I spent with a couple of my colleagues probably almost 2 years from the very first contact to the moment the first TED Talk was released, talking with people up and down the Vatican hierarchy, until one day I got an SMS message from my main contact at the Vatican, and the message just said, "The Pope said yes." And then at the moment, of course, the real work starts, because then you need to create the talk and you need to make sure that it's compelling and all that. Mm-hmm. I think we succeeded, and what we did, of course, the Pope doesn't travel to go to a conference like TED at the other end of the world to give a talk, right? Mm-hmm. And the travels is a gigantic machine that moves. But so we recorded the talk at Vatican City, and then we showed it at our main conference. It was presented in the program, just for the anecdote, it was presented in the program as a surprise speaker.
Oh, okay. And so they didn't know he was coming.
Exactly. And so as I was going around the Congress Center, people would ask, who's the secret speaker? And I would say, oh, he's a head of state. And the Pope is a head of state.
He is.
But nobody thinks of the Pope as a head of state. People think of the Pope as the head of the Catholic Church, not as, you know, the head of Vatican City, which is a state. Mm-hmm. And so the surprise was total when we released the talk, which happened both on stage in front of 2,000 people live and online at the same time.
Well, incredible coup, bringing him to a new audience and setting you into the stratosphere. Bruno, before I let you go, maybe you're coming to Dublin soon. What are you going to be doing here?
I'm going to participate in the AIB Sustainability Conference on Monday. We're going to talk about climate. We're going to talk about the state of climate, and we're going to talk about the challenges that we are faced with. I've spent the last 5 years at TED co-founding, developing and running a program called TED Countdown, which was a specific climate-focused, nature-focused, environmental-focused program within TED, using the tools of TED, the talks and all the rest, to highlight solutions to the climate crisis, solutions of any kind, anything from technology to finance to governance to policy, and so on.
Well, Bruno, listen, we hope you enjoy your time in Dublin and good luck with your venture. And thank you for sharing your story of how you created the Storytellers of the World. That was Bruno Giussani. Thank you very much for joining us today here on
News Talk. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Now, don't forget that News Talk is the home of the TED Radio Hour here in Ireland. You can tune in each Saturday at either 7 a.m. or p.m. to hear the latest episodes. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Next week, we're going to have a Taking Stock election special. It's a programme that's going to be looking at all of the election results. It's going to start at the earlier time of 8 a.m. and we'll be on air until 10. We've got a great lineup of the great and the good from Irish politics and the media to give you a first look at how the new government might be shaping up. So tune in. Thanks to all of today's guests and to series producer of Taking Stock, John Farty, with Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane on research and Hugo De Silva-Scott on sound. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.